It's not linear, and it's more, the journey is more jagged, because although we talk in an ideal sense about a continuum of care that could link sort of home and community options to more medicalized custodial options like nursing homes, the fact is that in our funding, we've really starved the intermediate part of the continuum. For example, assisted living, which is what is in greatest demand. That's, of course, for people who have some need for support with activities of daily living, but they don't require ongoing skilled nursing care. And the kind of population or census in nursing homes, even with this aging in our society, has remained relatively flat nationally. That's because of people's preferences for and the need for these intermediate settings such as assisted living.
And that's also a policy choice, too. The federal government since 2013, 2014 has been moving to try to keep people in home more.
Yes, in home. And, of course, so when they're in their homes, often it places a great burden on friends and family and neighbors. But to finish the other thought, assisted living in the United States continues to be almost exclusively private pay. And so what we're doing with our public dollars is we are channeling them overwhelmingly toward the most expensive and medicalized options for care, rather than to the especially needed and intermediate options such as assisted living.
Is there any sign that's going to change?
Well, it's like turning a ship around in the ocean. I would say that there are very small incremental changes. There are what is called waiver programs, where states go to the federal government and ask for flexibility to take some of their Medicaid dollars, for example, and channel them away from nursing homes and toward assisted living. And so that's happening. There are sort of pilot waiver programs across the country. In the whole scheme of things, though, that's still a very, very minor part of the picture. And if we don't change it, this is what we think in terms of interesting kind of issues about social change and political advocacy. If we don't begin to reduce the percentage of people who are older or who have chronic disability in nursing homes, it's very soon going to claim almost the entire discretionary state budget of states like Illinois, Ohio, Wisconsin, and others. And so it's really not sustainable. And what we have largely for-profit nursing home industry. About two-thirds of the nursing home beds are for-profit. We have their interests and their lobbying power within Washington pitted against the public good and the public needs of people for long-term care.
Well, we're seeing in the debate over the future of the McLean County nursing home, even this week, that the for-profit sector is not going to take Medicaid beds. It's not going to take the poorest people. It's only going to take those who can pay for it. What is the implication of that?
Well, the government sets reimbursement rates. And if they set them too low, you set the stage for exactly the dilemma that you describe. But what's behind the scenes, and this is part of what we see represented in this book of which I'm part and that I edited, is that American families, ultimately the great majority of them, are going through contortions in their own lives to provide this care in the midst of their paid work and other obligations. And so any notion that sort of family obligations have retreated, I think, is not supported in any way. It's really quite fanciful. What we see instead is that because of this gap in our social policies, families are going through great efforts to try to provide this care. And ultimately, there's a sort of a very strong gender theme in the book as well, because what we see has to do with the feminization of poverty. Women who have historically had the greatest responsibility to provide this care, often they are either cutting back on school or work or leaving work early in order to provide the care at home before nursing home care might be indicated or required. And in so doing, they are jeopardizing their own economic security later in life. And so this is, I think, sort of like a very key sort of political policy and cultural issue of our time, really.
What are the implications for economic growth as a nation if the government continues to deal with it as its policies currently are, and the tension between family obligations and earning one's keep continue to grow?
Wow, that's a complicated question. One aspect of it that I might touch on has to do with that sort of too often invisible army of paid caregivers who are filling in the gap that we've already discussed. You know, that gap that family members can't address. So just very briefly, we have, with the baby boomer cohorts, not only a very large cohort, but we have, with the increasing, in a sense, demand for care in later life, we have a decreasing supply because this cohort has had fewer children. More of them are unmarried. About half the baby boomers have experienced a divorce. And so we ask, how are people making it in the United States? In no small part, they're relying on home health aides, certified nursing assistants, and others. And in terms of economic growth and just economic justice, this is perhaps the most numerically large and fastest growing sector of the service economy in the United States today. And yet we still have the vast majority of these workers operating at perhaps only maybe 10, 15%, 20% over minimum wage, mostly working without fringe benefits. And so we have, in a sense, it could be a great opportunity to enrich these jobs and to save public dollars by providing care more cheaply in home and community-based settings. What we've done, however, is nourished the medical long-term care sector at the expense of all of these other needs.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Chris Whelan, an ISU scholar who's an author and editor of a new book on critical gerontology, coming out within the next month and a half. As you noted, the wages for these in-home care people and the front line workers tend to be very low. You write in one of the two chapters you author that creates a tension between the qualities needed to exercise high-quality care and the economic opportunity. How complex is that level of caregiving?
So, historically, certified nursing assistants, it's right there in the phrase, they took their place in essentially a hierarchical medical division of labor. They were present and are present, of course, for example, in hospital care. In the hospital setting, CNAs, certified nursing assistants, sort of exist at kind of invisibly at the bottom of a hierarchy of kind of medical expertise. They provide an important function, but they are kind of invisible, and we think of their work as essentially very limited, sort of manual, impersonal kinds of tasks. When we shift to home health care or assisted living, of course, then we see the CNA or the home health aide as a central actor in providing care. They're not part of a complex division of labor, and yet, partly because of that legacy of the medical model, we tend to diminish and demean the nature of their work. We see it as essentially bodily work, bodily care, rather than care for the person in a more holistic sense. But what adds to this, critically, has been gender theory, which I mean the work has been seen largely as unskilled because these tasks of nurturance, to the extent that we really think carefully about them, are seen as sort of instinctual for women, capabilities that women just naturally have and as such are not skilled in the sense that, like, a classical economist would regard them.
The emotional intelligence, the need to deal with the person and their emotional needs at the same time you're dealing with their body and the dignity and the embarrassment that and invasiveness that home care often produces.
Precisely, and it also has to do, for example, with monitoring a complicated medical conditions. Their skills have to do with sensitive communication among family members, which is often fraught with conflict.
High emotional intelligence.
Emotional intelligence. They have to know about particular how to read, for example, and support communication that might be impaired by cognitive decline. All of these are aspects of the skill of certified nursing assistants and home health aides.
Are you going to get that skill set with just above minimum wage?
Well, this is an interesting chicken and egg issue. Some of the economic arguments would have it that such workers don't deserve more than minimum wage because, after all, their skills are already sort of in a priori fashion defined as minimal, and they have modest formal credentials. And so another way that we are slowly but surely trying to attack this problem is that the training for CNAs, and some of it goes on, of course, right here in our community, the training has expanded and been enhanced, I think, in some significant ways. And the roles of such workers are being expanded to a certain extent. I'll give you a very brief example of what's called the medical home model. In the medical home model, which is partly an attempt to keep people either out of hospitals or to avoid hospital readmissions, home health aides, generally minimum wage, become kind of the eyes and ears of nurses. They're out in the community, and they can monitor chronic conditions such as diabetes, hypertension, whatever they might be, in a way that allows them to anticipate and prevent more costly medical events. So I think the medical home model is not only the wave of the future with respect to preventative medicine and controlling the inflation and hospital costs, but at the same time, it can be a mechanism for increasing the skills and then, one hopes, the compensation of home health aides.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Chris Whelan is our guest. He's the editor and author of a couple of chapters in a new book on critical gerontology. Is history a guide to how fast policy can change? If we have this semi-truck sized load of baby boomers heading toward retirement and a need for in-home care to remain at least semi-independent for a little longer as they become old and very old. That's a fairly unprecedented event in the nation's history. But is there any sort of guide as to how fast healthcare policy can change that we can use as a crystal ball?
I wish I could be more optimistic about this. We've seen the continued tortured and, I fear, often distorted discourse about the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act has an impact here because, of course, it introduced more preventative care and access to health care earlier, which can, in some sense, avoid what we call the compression of morbidity or the compression of illness later in life. And that there were incentives in the Affordable Care Act, for example, to avoid hospital readmissions, that essentially created a bit of a tide, I think, for enhancing the quality of jobs and training for the workers that we're talking about. But what we see now in the current administration is essentially an attempt to dismantle the Affordable Care Act sort of root and branch. And so we've seemed to have taken sort of one step forward and a couple of steps back.
Is there not a sign, though, that the policy incentive to take a couple steps back will not entirely take root because healthcare delivery organizations recognize that this is lower cost for them. So they're pushing this continuum of care model themselves now.
I think that to the extent that there is optimism, one finds this rooted in a kind of convergence or confluence of actors and groups and interests. State governments facing unsustainable Medicaid costs have a very strong incentive to fight back against this narrow lobbying by the nursing home industry. Family members, of course, under our current system, as we all know, in order to qualify for Medicaid, for long-term care, you qualify by virtue of poverty. You have to spend down your assets. So we have middle class or even affluent people in the last years of their lives having to drain their finances, drain their legacy to the next generation in order to sustain their support of vulnerable members of their families. And so we have that interest of the family members. We also have this large group of workers in the service economy. And so there seems to be a sort of triangulation of interests that all point in one direction, Charlie.
This is perhaps beyond your scope, but what are the implications to the maintenance of a strong middle class in the United States with that pressure on families to exhaust income? If there is no generational continuity, you're having to recreate a middle class culture and existence without an asset base.
I couldn't agree more. As we said before, one implication is the continued multi-generational kind of feminization of poverty. And
but in this case, it's not just feminine.
Yes, that's exactly right. And so I think that people, it's kind of an invisible struggle in the sense that, generally speaking, this happens late in people's lives. Family members feel at that point that they're dealing with kind of a very private dilemma, and the system, navigating the system, is really difficult. And so at that point, you know, the great sociologist C. Wright Mills, you know, we inherit this distinction that he gave us back in the late 50s between a private troubles and public issues. I think recently, exactly as with childcare, because almost everything that I've said about care work, low-wage care work, we could insert childcare into that discussion and we'd lose almost nothing. The same assumption of low skills, the same exploitative sort of labor market with very, very high turnover. Okay. It affects sort of the vast majority of families, but there has yet to be a kind of collective political voice that's come to bear. But what you say is absolutely true. I can say from, you know, personal experience and from my expertise right now, high-quality assisted living today in the United States would range anywhere from probably $4,500 to $7,000 a month. Would be at least this $60,000, $70,000 a year could easily exhaust the savings of many middle-class people. And it's a really poignant thing. It's happening all around us, and it's often goes sort of unacknowledged.
If policy were to shift, there is still a problem about quality control and about oversight. These home care workers are operating solo in a lot of ways in addressing a population that is easily exploitable, and family members are not there because they're at their jobs or geographically distant or any number of other things that takes them out of the home as well. How is the public case going to be made for government to pay for this when mechanisms of oversight and the potential for fraud or abuse is pretty high?
I think that potential is real. I think that it is vastly increased and exacerbated when you have such marginal structural labor market conditions. That is, we're talking about people who could work full-time and earn $30,000 a year without any benefits. In such conditions, the potential for resentment or abuse, I think, are a lot higher. So it was interesting, like a small test case in San Francisco. I lived for a time and worked in the Bay Area. They have an in-home supportive service network, which is like a municipal outgrowth of government. And what they did is they essentially moved toward a living wage for in-home supportive workers. These people support either working age or older people in their homes. And they instituted like a significant raise in the income, in the salary structure. And to nobody's surprise, turnover dropped. And so what we have in mind now, and this I touch on this in my own chapter in the book, there are many – what you say is true. The regulations and training vary vastly across states, but there are best practices. We really know people who do this work tend to have a high moral commitment to the work. If you build in something close to a living wage, graduated raises that are tied to things like in-service training and basic fringe benefits that keep people in the jobs, where those moves have been instituted, turnover drops, quality and continuity of care are enhanced. And so it strikes me like we sort of already know the solution. We're just not following it. There's a group called the Pioneer Network and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has spent millions of dollars studying things. And the research evidence, of which there is a mountain, is really quite persuasive that when you involve frontline care workers in care decisions, when you respect them enough to be part of that team, and when you give them ongoing professional development, turnover falls, quality of care increases. And that, I think, those benefits are what should be sort of like the North Star that we should be following.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Chris Whelan is an Illinois State University professor and editor and author of a new book on critical gerontology. We've already talked about the gender divide and the impacts that gender has on the economics of this particular area. What about ethnic backgrounds? There's a chapter or two that deals with that. What does that show?
In some ways, and in some places particularly, it's kind of an ethnic labor niche. In, for example, the nationwide frontline care workers, CNAs and home health aides, are disproportionately likely to be African American, Latino, or women from other countries.
Filipino.
And that was very true in San Francisco. And often there is sort of like chain hiring, where certain corporate groups will hire members of a family, knowing that they...
That's a hot button word to stick in the debate.
Absolutely has become that. And so, for example, I think that aside from fast food and other kinds of lower wage service sector jobs, many people in these communities, partly based on their own family experiences of giving care to grandparents and others, partly because of religious or spiritual or sort of moral commitments, they're really drawn to do this work. It sounds anomalous because of the low wages, but, you know, I've been involved in this work for a long time and talked to people. I did the work myself as a younger person, and you'll hear people commonly say that they're called to do the work. They're called to do the work, meaning they feel that to deal with vulnerable people and to help to expand their autonomy is sort of like a very exalted way for them to define their roles.
A moral act, yeah.
It is a moral act. And they may, given that the formal educational credentials for the work are lower, for all of these reasons, what we have is a darker hue or complexion of the direct care workforce. It's still overwhelmingly female. That's certainly true.
How about on the patient side? What is the experience of a Latina or Latino patient compared to a WASP?
Well, I don't have as much direct knowledge of that, but I'll say the following. In the past, we often thought that, for example, people would say about the Latino community that such people kind of would never accept putting a loved one in a nursing home, as though that was sort of an abandonment. But I think that some of the research that I've seen suggests that all ethnic and national communities have that sense of filial obligation. What we see is that once these groups enter the middle class and they have competing work demands or they have single families, they, whether the Latino or African-American communities or others, probably come to look more like the white population in terms of their likelihood of interacting with the formal care system. What we'd also have to add to that, however, is kind of like a stigma. I think there's been distrust, frankly, within the African-American community about the medical complex. It's rooted in things like the Tuskegee experiments and other kinds of things. But essentially, I think nobody embraces, for example, nursing home care. But it's also the case in lower-income communities, whether you're Latino, African-American, or white, it's more often the case that you have dense networks, interdependent networks of support and caregiving that can be activated for the care of older people. It goes back to even classic works like Carol Stack's book, All Our Kin, where we talk about how people, lower-income people, people struggling with poverty, they tend to stick together more often geographically and socially in order to be a sort of a bulwark against hard times. But I would think, and it's an empirical question, if we were to look at middle-class and more affluent African-American Latino communities, we see probably something closer to the general pattern with respect to long-term care utilization.